I'm Alex Hirsch, and I'm not Rob Renzetti.
I'm Rob Renzetti, and I'm not Matt Chapman.
I'm Matt Chapman, and I'm both Alex Hirsch and Rob Renzetti.
What?
So,
what a twist.
Now that you're thoroughly educated about who we are, welcome to Into the Bunker, second episode of season two. This is an episode I am pretty proud of. I think we won an Annie Award for this episode.
Did we? Oh,
my
Lord.
If I recall correctly.
There should be a little Annie in the corner of the episode.
Award winning.
An award that nobody knows outside of the animation industry.
There should
Let's
just be
put
a,
it on the screen.
Can, yeah, maybe we can add a watermark of Grunkle Stan just saying, we won a thing! this episode was written by, I believe, Matt Chapman and myself. Is that correct, Matt?
That's correct. I think it was just the two of us.
I think it was the two of us.
So intimate.
And this episode, when season two was greenlit, we kind of got everybody together in a little bit of a brain trust, and we said, okay, we're doing another season. This is going to be our last season. So what are the things that we've always wanted to do in Gravity Falls that we haven't done yet? And high up on my list was I definitely wanted to do a Thing homage, John Carpenter's The Thing, because
yes,
it's one of my favorite movies.
It's one of the best movies
of all
ever.
Time. It's the best. I definitely wanted to do something where we revisited that switch in the woods, just to, like, all cards on the table here. Like, that tree thing going into the ground, 100% inspired by the Windows 95 CD-ROM game Myst with a Y. If anybody listening to this is a million years old, you may have played this game. A lot of the Gravity Falls lore, like the journal and that tree, like, is like kind of me just like going back to my memories of playing this game Myst. I kind of wanted to just kind of directly rip it off in this episode for that opening.
How many blue pages does Dipper find versus red pages?
He finds an equal amount of blue and red pages and must make a very difficult choice. There's also references to Myst in journal number 3. For those of you who have no social lives, look it up. It's there. beyond those references and the mystery, the most important thing was we had felt in season one when me and Michael Rianda were planning out some of the broad architecture of the series, we imagined like, yep, Dipper and Wendy, Wendy and Dipper, Dipper pining after Wendy for episode after episode. And as season one was winding to a close, we started getting a lot of feedback from audience members just being like, yeah, okay, we get it. He's got an unrequited crush. It's not going anywhere. Can we move on?
Right.
There was a deliberate choice in the writer's room to be like, you know what? That arc that we were waiting for, let's just get it out of the way.
Yeah.
And let's just like have Wendy be a member of the team and have her be somebody who goes on adventures and have Dipper have to deal with this inevitable heartbreak sooner than later.
Yes.
What was that? I feel like on a board it was referred to as, like, it said like kill the crush, or there was something that was like who is the author, revisit the switch thing and like kill the
kill
Wendy
the crush.
Dipper.
Well, and Matt Chapman has the distinction of, for some reason, he's written on a number of episodes where relationship hopes are dashed. He wrote Boys Crazy where Robbie and Wendy break up. This was like sort of, honestly, it was kind of like the early days of the Tumblr fan communities when the show was coming on and like phrases like shipping were entering the nomenclature.
Yeah.
And like we referred to Matt Chapman as the shipwrecker. Do you remember
that,
Matt?
I wore it like a badge of honor after Boys Crazy because that was the first episode I wrote on, and they were like, I don't know who this Matt Chapman is. This is his first episode, and he clearly, Alex Hirsch, didn't have a control over this one because he would never have let Wendy and Robbie break up. I don't know what this guy did.
No, I remember when you tied up Alex in his office and then wrote that script and then produced it and then put it on the air.
Yeah, it was a good
without
week.
Without Alex ever escaping.
That was like the only sleep I got all year. That was great. Do that anytime. This line right here, Mabel saying, allow me to put on my skepticals. That's actually like back in like whatever, 2011, when the very first time I drew Dipper, when I was brainstorming that character, that was one of my like Dipper lines of dialogue, allow me to put on my skepticals. I never found room for it until this episode. So I'm always ripping off my past self. If there's a line that I think is funny, I will never let it go, even if it's not funny.
Well, no, sure.
As with Inconveniencing, this episode, because it deals with Wendy and Dipper and Wendy's relationship, and because there's that's something that's a little bit difficult to thread the needle on, this episode went through a number of changes in the script phase. And actually, that scene that we open up with, that cold open, was probably the last thing added to this episode. It was a tricky thing where we were trying to thread, how do we have Dipper be both invested in this adventure and also invested in this Wendy crush. And sort of that scene in the beginning was added to sort of really show, like, Dipper is a little bit buoyed by the confidence of beating Gideon in the last season. He's feeling like maybe it's time to go for it. And the moment Wendy says, like, yeah, I don't need this. I don't need guys. They're, you know, like she needs to give him that idea that it's impossible and hopeless, so that he can be sort of in turmoil in this story.
I like the laying on the bra thing is maybe one of my favorite like awkward kid moments, because I was terrified of the other sex's underpants and underwears when I was that age.
Well, that's a direct memory. Like I'm trying to think of like what are actual memories, and it's like that first time you go over to, like, if you're a girl going over to a boy's house or a boy going over to a girl's house, just like seeing their laundry hamper and just being like, I shouldn't be here, you know. It's just this sense that like you're not ready
I've seen
to be
too
around.
Much.
This level.
Yeah.
I felt that way way into my 20s, by the way.
This was season 2, and at this point we had really managed to accumulate just an amazing team of artists, and this episode just looks beautiful. You know, credit to our art team for this. That bunker was so well resolved. You know, freeze frame it. Look at all the details in there.
This room is a great. Was this in the script? I'm guessing, but this is such a great invention, and the visuals are so strong here.
Matt, do you remember? We had a number of different ideas about traps, right?
It was like it was much vaguer, sort of like kind of like an Indiana Jones sort of like gonna die room, but the artists are the ones that really made this thing.
Script called for gonna die room, and huge credit to Neil Graff, storyboard artist who was not on the show for very long, but he left his mark on it with this scene.
Yeah, this is just an amazing bit of choreography, this whole thing.
Well, and it's genuinely stressful. Like, I get claustrophobic watching this. Like, that's metal.
It's probably, it feels like it's probably the most realistic danger the characters ever get into.
You really feel like they might be
boned
if they don't.
It's just so mechanically figured out, and it feels like they really are in there.
Well, and it's one of these things where, you know, retroactively, I had to, like, our board artist created it. It was so cool. And then there was this question of, why would Ford build this? And when Rob and I were working on the journal, I added a little detail suggesting that Ford was scared that the shapeshifter might escape. So he built a room that would change shape as a way of confusing the shapeshifter.
Yep.
So, it all makes sense, kids. We're geniuses. That's called a retcon.
Yeah.
Retroactive continuity.
That's the journal's subtitle, actually. The actually physically written journal.
The Chronicles of Retcon. But, you know, a nice plausible retcon can be quite satisfying.
Yeah.
I buy it.
Me too.
I remember we're going to try and make the bunker somehow link up with the Stan's room, like the portal room underneath the shack. We had, like, drawn this, like, ridiculous map on the whiteboard of Gravity Falls. We're like, can we make it work? Can it go from the forest all the way over? And the kids were going to maybe, like, go in an elevator for a second.
Yeah.
And, like, it would open up to Stan's floor, but they wouldn't know. They'd be like, oh, there's nothing on this floor. And then it would close, and a second later, Stan would walk by. And then we were just like, that is literally only there to troll the fans.
Yeah.
And serves no purpose other than that.
I mean, because we couldn't have them discover the link between this place and the Mystery Shack this early in the season.
It was a really cool idea. I remember we had a number of we tried to figure out a way to make it work. And there originally, I think, was a thin Grunkle Stan B story in this episode where we see him operating the portal and we see on his surveillance that these are all connected, but he doesn't notice.
Right.
We were really concerned that audiences would be super impatient, like, you showed us the portal, let's get to it. And we tried in these early episodes to find ways to suggest that, and we ended up cutting all of that for time just because there wasn't room. And I think to the betterment of the episode.
Yeah. I mean, that's another thing we kind of retconned in the journal was the, like, there was this thought of, like, okay, so Ford was in town working on the portal, and then he built this whole other complex.
Some unrelated complex.
And why did he do that, and how did he do that, and how did he do that as a man alone? And we just kind of retconned all that stuff. We retconned the heck out of that in the journal, like, McGull could help him. They hired a bunch of people, and then they erased their memory.
Yeah, that's my explanation for why there's, like, such amazing inventions that would take whole teams of people is that McGucket secretly hired a number of contractors and erased their minds. Like, I think of McGucket as being, like, a really sweet, nice guy completely in over his head who just, like, oh, well, once I've erased one guy's mind, I gotta erase 10 more guys' mind to cover it up, and it just sort of builds into, like, I guess I'm kind of this kingpin of crime and I'm starting a cult. I didn't mean to! Whoopsie-daisy! This sequence was storyboarded by Joe Pitt, who did a really fantastic job. One of the hardest things about this episode was we had to, in order for the misdirect to play, and again, we're just assuming you've all seen this, so if you haven't, watch it and then listen to the commentary, but in order to make this misdirect play, we really had to make it plausible that this guy was the author. And I remember Matt did a great job in the script of these really oddball lines like, you know, I've been down here for days, weeks, I miss orange juice. Like, he sounds distinctively like a nutcase, but he's sort of charming enough that you're like, maybe he's the actual author. And Mark Hamill did a wonderful job as the fake author.
I mean, he's an amazingly versatile voice actor for those who don't know his animation work. But besides the fact that he's
a vocal shapeshifter, so he was perfect for this character.
He's amazing.
Yeah, when you first played me this, I was like so excited to hear Luke Skywalker talking, and then I was just like, wait, that's just a different guy. That's great. I couldn't hear any Mark Hamill in it whatsoever.
That's a gruff older dude. His design was very particular. We went through a number of passes on this design. Originally, he looked a little bit more like an oddball, wacky inventor, and I felt he had to be pretty idiosyncratic. There's certain color things about him. You'll notice he's more or less got the color scheme of the journal, you know, maroons and golds, so that you kind of feel like instinctively like maybe that's him.
Well, then he also had to make sense as a Beans mascot.
Yes, and he also had to be plausible as what Dr. Zeppelin's high-flying Rootitude Beans? I can't remember exactly.
Well, you'll see it soon enough.
Yeah, we'll see it soon enough.
That's a small Venn diagram to hit the target in there between those two. A lot of these motifs, though, we would end up using in Ford's design as well, the gloves and the coat and all that, but, you know, much cooler later on. But, yeah, I mean,
The goggles.
Sort of preparing you. It's Ford Light.
Light. The sort of idea that I had, and it was sort of tricky to make it all hook up, but the way I sort of imagined it in my mind was that the shapeshifter can somehow turn into anything he sees. Just by sight, he could put together everything he needs to be that thing. But he never actually saw Ford, that Ford would use a mask or Ford would, you know, obscure his face or always had goggles on or something. So he couldn't properly imitate Ford. He could only imitate what he saw around to be like Ford. And for those of you who read the journal, the shapeshifter has a pretty tragic tale. He was Ford's pet who just got way too powerful, way too quick, which is alluded to in these pages that we see flipping through real fast. This was also the first episode that Robert Ryan Corey, one of our designers, ever worked on.
Yeah, did a great job.
If you haven't heard of Robert Ryan Corey, look him up. He is one of the best living monster and gross-out character designers in cartoons today. Every close-up drawing you've ever seen of SpongeBob where you think you might have to go to therapy after seeing that drawing, that was drawn by Corey. And a lot of these shapeshifter poses...
As therapy, actually.
Yeah.
That was therapy for Corey to draw those things.
Yeah, well, Corey's had a strange life, and I asked him one time what his secret to drawing monsters was, and he said, you can't draw monsters unless you've seen monsters, which I think tells you everything you need to know about his universe.
But here, this is his design work right here. This I thought he did a really great job of making a monster that seemed unique and different than what I've ever seen before, honestly. I'm sure there are influences, whatever, but just got a very particular... style that doesn't really look like anything else I've seen.
Yeah, so I mean, this was the second time. These first two episodes, I've said in other episodes how, like, in Gravity Falls, I don't want to just have a regular zombie. I don't want to just have a regular shapeshifter. But these are basically just classic monsters. Like, we didn't add some crazy new idea to them. We just tried to breathe some humor and good execution into them. And I got to give designers credit for making them feel specific, even though they are a trope.
Yeah. Love that character. A lot of fun.
I want to play a video game with that guy and do my roll attack through the tunnels.
Yeah, my favorite Pokemon. This was a tricky episode because I remember when we got the storyboards all together and I pitched it to the crew for the first time, there was this sort of sinking feeling in my gut that maybe we had overshot it in terms of tonal realism. Like, you know, it's a lot more grounded in many ways than a lot of our other episodes. And you know, that danger felt very real, and it's all underground and in the dark, and you see all this kind of Fallout looking very grounded, ancient looking stuff. And I remember when I pitched the episode, there weren't a lot of big laughs, and I was a little concerned that, like, maybe we've broken the tone. And I remember in Animatic, I tried to add as many gags as I could, just goofy stuff like Mabel turning on her sweatshirt as a light.
Yeah.
Just like silly little punchlines as a way to try to make it still feel within the Gravity Falls world. But, you know, I'm actually really happy with this. I feel like this episode does a much better job at representing the tone of what I wanted this series to feel like than a lot of episodes. Like, yeah. This is probably in my top five of, like, this feels like Gravity Falls to me.
This is a better, darker episode than I'd say the Karaoke is, just in terms of, like, yeah. We talked about this on that commentary, but just all the heavy lifting that Karaoke had to do to reintroduce the show and set up where we were going in season two. And this episode has those same elements, but just so much lighter, so much easier to get through. The Crusher then with Wendy is such a relatable, human story. It's just easy to get. It's beautifully explored here. It's just there's so many good moments of a prepubescent boy really suffering at the hands of this girl who's so much cooler than him, so far beyond anything he could help to even
understand.
Yeah.
And we really wanted to make this a really standout episode for Wendy. Like, we wanted to spend a lot of time with her. We wanted to see her, that she could really hold her own on these adventures, and that she's a really valuable addition. And it's one of my regrets in the season that we didn't get much more of that. We returned to it in Weirdmageddon 1. Every time Wendy is part of the team, she is awesome.
Yeah.
Hey, man, I got to write the words, Wendy buries a hatchet in the chest of the other Wendy in a screenplay. I felt pretty awesome. I remember, like, we were all just sort of acting out when we thought of that moment of just, like, two Wendys and Dipper and one of them screaming, like, Wendy, kill the Wendy! Or, you know, Dipper, kill the Wendy! And we were like, whoa! And it always, I feel like both Jason Ritter and Linda Cardellini, like, did such a good job of selling this whole part. Does get, like, I'll get a little goosebumpy. I won't lie.
Yeah, this is probably the most amount of takes we ever did for any line is Dipper believing Wendy is dead. Not because Jason's not awesome, but just because that's a hard thing to sell, and it's a really vulnerable moment. And we tried to get Dipper as close to really feeling that as possible before this twist. And I think it's honestly a pretty good misdirect. Like, I don't ever think they're really going to kill Wendy, but we're making the most out of what a shapeshifter can give you in a story. I mean, that's what I love so much about The Thing, is that the shapeshifter is just a tool to catalyze stress between all the other characters.
Yeah.
And this episode, that's the same theory. There it is. Dipper buries a chest in fake Wendy, and she transforms.
This is truly horrifying stuff.
It is a pretty nightmarish scene. And Mark Hamill does a wonderful job making this monster not just scary because of his forms, but he seems like he's 10 steps ahead of the characters for most of this episode. You know, up until this moment, he's really kind of got their numbers, very manipulative. And I love this idea that right before he freezes, he transforms into anything he can think of to try to escape.
And this.
Oh, yeah.
Little epilogue where he comes back and basically says, here's what you look like when you die, Dipper.
What you're up against. You will never find the author if you keep digging.
Does it come back? Does he at some point?
What he looks like in Northwest Mansion Mystery, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
When he turns into
that's
wood.
So great.
It's the same pose.
The shapeshifter predicted Dipper potentially turning to wood. Were it not for Pacifica, the shapeshifter's prediction would have actually come true. Excellent, excellent pose by Joe Pitt there. So this ending, probably one of the hardest endings that we had to write.
We wrote this about five times in the animatic room, didn't we? I mean, we're all throwing out.
Picture like me and Rob at just like, you know, 1 a.m. like just reading heartfelt. I've always loved you for so long.
Is that too much?
Do you feel it? No. Okay. How about? Love is temporary, but friendship is real love. How about that?
I think where we landed was good because we kind of have tried to avoid as much of that cliche as possible. And I really like the, like what she says, don't be itchy or whatever to Dipper.
That was a very late. I remember that was something I wrote very late, and you liking it is why I kept it in.
Yeah, I thought where we landed, but there was a lot of like, putting a line into the animatic, one line, change one line. Okay, yeah. Watch it again from 2 minutes out, rolling into it, and then like, no, it doesn't work. Well,
the first time that we watched this in sort of the animatic with the music and all the boards, it felt, by no fault of anyone's, it felt almost romantic. It almost felt like a romantic comedy, and like the whole subplot with Dipper's sort of infatuation with Wendy is inspired by my own memories of puberty, and it's not a romantic time. It's a nightmare. It's supposed to be this really terrifying thing for Dipper. Like, his heart is in his throat the moment he realizes he has to have this conversation, and he's just frozen, waiting for it to pass, and Wendy can see that pain, and she's just like doing everything right. She can to show him nothing's different. Everything's normal.
Right.
You're normal. These feelings are normal. I'm a couple years older than you, and I've been around. I've seen this. We all go through it. You're going through it, but you're going to be okay. And to make it not a will they, won't they, but to make it a like a you know, a rite of passage, a coming of age, that's how this should feel. And Sometimes that tone is difficult to strike, because I think all writers, we all have our sort of like bag of kind of tropes in our pocket, which can be really useful when you're trying to craft an adventure, but when you're trying to make a human turn like this,
yeah,
you kind of have to like really try to like break those tropes and make it feel real. Yeah. If you can,
I mean, and the will they won't they is really like, will they be friends after this?
Yeah.
Because there's a very legitimate path where Wendy's like, dude, you're creeping me out.
Yeah,
you know
sure.
what I mean? Like, maybe we should take a little time away from each other, because this is not healthy
and
for
Wendy's
either one
coolness
of us.
Is yeah, the revealed
fact
double
she's
there.
So beautiful in that scene. She treats him so well. When
it shows that she was the awesome kind of person he always thought she was.
Matt, you want to talk about this? About your amazing
this is
announcer
just,
job
fun
here?
To be, I would love to host to be this kind of guy. If locally, anybody that works in the Atlanta area on a local affiliate, I would happily do the late night announcing.
And Man With No Taste, I'm very happy to see, has become a meme. I've seen people troll each other with it.